We are together looking at the Bible's big story, and we are at that part in the Gospels where we see Jesus on the move. And we began the Gospels by describing it as heaven breaking through. Sally Lloyd-Jones in the Bible storybook describes it like this: Jesus was making the sad things come untrue. He was mending God's broken world. And everything that we saw being done in Genesis 3 in particular, we see Jesus undoing, putting right. And in particular, here in the Gospels, and to a certain extent, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we see Jesus calming storms. We see Jesus calming storms in the lives of the broken. Remember the woman who had been living with her bleeding for 12 years and a 12-year-old girl taken from her family. And then with you in last Sunday, we had Jesus calming the storm as he's on Galilee with the disciples. And the chapter last week ended with this remarkable conclusion where it says in Mark chapter 4 and verse 41, "And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, 'Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?'" And it's a question, isn't it? What were they more afraid of? The storm or the one who calmed it? The storm, or the one who said with a word, "Be still," and it was. I wonder if you know that all four Gospels record the feeding of the 5,000. And if all four Gospels record the feeding of the 5,000, it makes you wonder whether or not this story itself is vital in understanding who Jesus is. Whether it's vital in understanding what he came to do. That it's vital in understanding how Jesus' ministry and mission fits into the Bible's big story. Because here is what we are discovering as we go through this week by week, is that the Bible's big story is Jesus. We asked this question at How to Share Your Faith last Sunday, and it wasn't a trick question, but it was this: what is it that makes Christianity different? And I'd imagine that lots of us would give some really good and really helpful answers. What is it that makes Christianity different? We would say, well, it's not a religion, it's a relationship. It's about grace, and we would unfold all these things. And all these answers are good, but here is what makes Christianity different: Christ. There's no one like him. And we're not meant to or intended to compare Jesus to Buddha or to Muhammad or to anyone else, because there is no one like him. It is he who is different. And all these things to do with grace and relationship outflow from who he is. He is the one who can calm the storms. He is the one who is able to feed the 5,000. Now, all four Gospels record this event, this miraculous feeding of such a big crowd. And all of them have very slight differences, but not one of them has a contradiction. Each of the disciples are standing from a slightly different viewpoint, and each of them in the story itself is fitting into the big story of their own gospel. And the key verse for us is here in Mark chapter 6, and we understand it because of what comes before and what comes after, in verse 34, where it says this: "When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd." And all four Gospels do this in the same way. All four of them describe a great crowd seeking out Jesus. In fact, you discover that in Mark, they are described as running ahead of him. The disciples thought they were getting the shortcut, they were getting the easy way in the boat. But they discover that people were so earnest to see Jesus that they ran. When did you last run? I was going to just leave it there at that statement. I realized that was too long a pause. But when did you last run to Jesus? Why did they run? What was it that had been happening? What was it that was happening in them that said, "It doesn't, nothing else matters. I'm not even taking a packed lunch with me. I'm going out of the door. And I'm going to meet him. I don't care where it is. I don't care how I get there. I just need to be there." There are all slight differences, but no contradictions. All of them describe a crowd seeking Jesus, not in a church building, not in a place of comfort, not in a time of their choosing that sits into the whole schedule, but out into the wilderness, out into a lonely place, because they know that they need something more. And in fact, what Mark is doing in his gospel here is answering this question: who is Jesus? Turn with me to Mark chapter 6 and verse 1, because this is a question that is being answered. Mark chapter 6 and verse 1, it says this: he went away from there and he came to his hometown, and his disciples followed him. And on the Sabbath he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were astonished, saying, "Where did this man get these things? What is the wisdom given to him? How were such mighty works done by his hands? Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? Are not his sisters here with us?" And they took offense at him. Who is Jesus? A couple of weeks ago, we said that there are three contexts in which we have to read the passage. And we began with a particular order of the context, but I want to reverse that order this morning. Here's the first context. How does this passage fit into the Bible's big story? I remember once when I was at primary school, our primary school teacher talking about this passage, and what she said was, this is just Jesus teaching people about how to share. That the boy shamed everyone to bringing out their packed lunches. What has that got to do with the Bible's big story? And what has that got to do with the majesty and glory of Jesus? Sharing is good, but it doesn't say it. And so the first question is, how does this passage fit into the Bible's big story? The second question is, how does this passage fit into Mark's gospel? And the last question is, how does it fit into this passage fit into the chapter? So there's three contexts: the big story, the gospel, and then the chapter. Well, let's begin with how does it fit into the big story. The big story of the Bible is that God is speaking, that God has got something to say. And we go right back to the Garden of Eden, where Adam and Eve have sinned, and they're hiding from God, and God is calling for them. And the rest of the Bible is a story of a God who speaks, of a God who is revealing himself, a God who is calling men and women to himself. And here is the lie that we believed in the Garden of Eden: that God doesn't love you, that he's holding the best life from you, that he's just trying to push you down and shove you out of the way. He doesn't love you. And that was the lie that Adam and Eve believed. And that is a lie that we are tempted to believe every single day. This might be a common experience. Something wrong happens. God, you don't love me. Why did you let that happen to me? Or you see somebody being blessed in a way that you have not been blessed. God, why don't you love me like them? What are we doing? Instinctively, it's in our heart. We're believing the lie that God doesn't love us. And yet we discover that something very familiar is happening in Mark's gospel. And if we turn to Mark chapter 1 and verse 35, let me show you what I mean. This is something familiar. Mark chapter 1 and verse 35. And rising very early in the morning, while it was still dark, he departed and went to a desolate place. There he prayed. And Simon and those who were with him searched for him, and they found him and said to him, "Everyone is looking for you." And he said to him, "Let us go into the next towns, that I may preach there also, for that is why I came out." And here's the big story. God has got something to say. God is speaking. God is undoing that which happened in the Garden of Eden. And everything that God has to say to you, this is brilliant, Everything that God has to say to you is found in Jesus. The big story is breaking in. But if that's the big context, what we discover is that this passage doesn't stand on its own. And in Mark's gospel, what we discover is that there's a series of contrasts. And here's one of the difficulties of kind of just picking passages out. Go to Mark chapter 6 at the end, not to the end rather, but go to the feeding of the 5,000, all right? Now, I kind of hope that what you did before you came this morning is that you prepared by reading these verses. That's my hope, that you sat down, you took just a few minutes and said, God, speak to me through this, maybe even wrote some questions that you would hope to be answered. But one of the negatives is this is, did anyone read the passage before? No, we didn't, did we? And I'm not criticizing the slightest for that, because that's not our instinct, because it says on the website, verse 30 to 45. Now, look at the passage before. What's happening there? There's another meal being taking place. There's another man who's a king. There's another outcome. And what you discover is that the feeding of the 5,000 in Mark doesn't stand on its own, but it's meant to stand in contrast with the passage that went before. You're meant to see that there are two kings here. There is King Herod and there is King Jesus. There are two banquets here. There is a banquet of Herod and there is a feast on the hillside. You're meant to see the contrast between those who were there. For King Herod, you had to be invited. And there were plenty of barriers put up. But here Jesus is saying, come to me. And King Herod, because it was for his birthday, we discovered that it's all about status. Those with status got to draw near. But here in Jesus, what's the criteria? Are you hungry? Come near. Do you see the contrasts? It's meant to be a contrast between two kingdoms. It's meant to be a contrast between two conclusions, where the big question being asked is, in what kingdom do we belong? What king do we follow? Or let me draw it down to the picture that is given. At what table are we sitting? Are we sitting glorifying in ourselves because we've been invited to the table of King Herod? And we go, "Who's like us?" Are you rejoicing because you're sitting at the king of the table of the king of the table of the King of Kings, where the only criteria is this: are you hungry? Come and eat. Are you thirsty? Come and drink. And so it's not a passage meant to be read in isolation. And so we can see how it fits into Mark's gospel. We can see how it fits into the big story. But look at how it starts. It begins with frustration. And rest is interrupted. Have you ever been somewhere and you're really tired and you drive home and you discover somebody's waiting for you there? And it's like, oh no. It's like, I'm just knackered. I can't do this. But Jesus has taken his disciples away for some rest and some time together, but they discover that the crowd that they were running from gets there first. Hello! And rest becomes responsibility. And look at the question, look at the command that Jesus gives them. He says, you feed them. I'm tired, but I'm weary. You feed them. And Jesus' response to the responsibility is remarkable. He has compassion. There was a church in Edinburgh that had a bench outside that was being used by prostitutes as a pickup spot. Do you know what their solution was? They got rid of the bench. They didn't want the responsibility. Look at Jesus' response. What did he see? When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things. What did he do? He began to teach them many things. He did not entertain them. He began to teach them many things. What is our greatest need? What is God saying to the church about our mission and calling? What was it that Jesus said to Peter when he was being restored to him? And that question was asked 3 times, do you love me? What was it that Jesus said to Peter? He said, feed my lambs, tend my sheep, feed my sheep. God is speaking, and Jesus is making it known. But then Jesus offers a challenge to the disciples. Look at what it says in verse 35. And when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, this is a desolate place and the hour is now late. They are so pragmatic. Notice they weren't so pragmatic at the start of Mark chapter 1 when it was something that they wanted, but that's another story. When it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, this is a desolate place and the hour is now late. Send them away into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. And the message is clear. We are at the end of our own resources. We've got nothing to offer. We've got nothing to give. And their language is quite careful. They are coming to Jesus and saying, Jesus, you deal with this. We've been brought to our own end of our own resources. And you sometimes wonder if that is the point of Jesus bringing them there. For the disciples, not the crowd, but for the disciples to discover where provision was found. For the disciples to discover where sufficiency is met. And even if you flick back in Mark, you discover that they've just come back from mission where Jesus had met their needs. And Jesus has said, I met your needs on the mission, but what about theirs? What about those that you've been sent to? Don't their needs matter? Or does the all-sufficiency of Jesus just depend on you? And the challenge of Jesus is this. He comes and says to them, you feed them. Why? Because you have what they need. Think of every excuse that we can come up with. And Jesus comes back to the same conclusion. You feed them. You have already what you need. What does a response reveal about themselves? What does a response reveal about how they see Jesus? And 2 big questions are being asked. The first is this. Is what God has put in our hands enough to what he has called us? The 2nd big question. Is Jesus limited by our capacity? And is the gospel that we proclaim one of scarcity? And 2 big questions are being asked of the disciples. 2 big questions are being asked with us. And this is what Jesus reveals. And this is where the excitement of the passage comes. You have the compassion, but what you also have is the sufficiency. You have the hunger, but you also have the need met. And when you see Jesus, what Jesus reveals about himself is that he is able, that he is sufficient, that this encounter is all about discovering who he is. Think of what it says in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 20. It says, now to him who is able to do far more abundantly than all that we ask or think according to the power at work within us. And this is what makes this passage not about sharing your picnic, but about somebody who can take 5 loaves and 2 fish and break it and feed others. And we're meant this morning to go home and go, hold on, my best friend can feed 5,000. He is all sufficient. Do you ever find being a Christian really dull? That coming to worship, uninteresting? I shouldn't say that because I can see some of you falling asleep. There is nothing more exciting. There is nothing more extravagant. There is nothing more supernatural. There is nothing more wonderful than a God who can take 5 loaves and 2 fish and feed 5,000. And we say being a Christian is about being a good person. How boring are you?
Is that it?
No. This is about the one who flung stars into space saying, I can take whatever I have and I can make whatever I want with it. All our eyes are meant to be in him. What is our expectation of Jesus? What do we see about the glory of Jesus? We are meant to finish this passage the same way that you finished last Sunday morning and go, who is this? I'm sorry, if you see Jesus as dull and uninteresting, then your eyes are closed and your heart is still hard. If you see Jesus as dull and uninteresting, then you still haven't seen him clearly, and ask God that he would open his eyes. If you still see Jesus as dull and uninteresting, then your hands are still full and you still don't realize how hungry you are. Because look at what this Jesus can do compared to all the pleasures and joys of the world. What does Jesus do? He satisfies. And they all ate and were satisfied. Jesus does not disappoint. He does not leave you hungry. There is enough for everyone who would come. Here is God's answer to the emptiness in here. Come, everyone who thirsts. Come to the waters, and he who has no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without price. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Listen diligently to me and eat what is good, and delight yourself in rich food. Incline your ear. Come to me. Hear that your soul may live, and I will make with you an everlasting covenant. The question that is being asked in this is, what table are you dining at? Where is satisfaction found? The world offers the table of Herod. Jesus offers the table of the king. You're being asked to choose your king. You're being asked to choose your kingdom. Listen to what Jesus says in Revelation chapter 3 and verse 20. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and eat with him, and he with me. Jesus can only bless those who come empty. Jesus can only satisfy those who come with nothing in their hands. Jesus can only bless those who come and say, nothing in my hands I bring, simply to the cross I cling. During the week, we're remembering at the evangelism course of something that Nigel Barge used to do in Torrance. He used to chat people's doors and go, are you happy? And if they said yes, he said, I can't help you. And he would go try the next door. And he would just ask, are you happy? Aren't you glad you don't live in Torrance? I always find it ironic the number of Christians who have signs on their doors that say no cold cellars, but quite happy for churches to chat in doors. But that's ironic. And he would go, are you happy? And one day a man opened the door and he asked the question, are you happy? And he was the first honest man. And he said, no, I'm not. And he said, well, let me tell you about Jesus. And he invited him in. And he became a Christian and discovered living bread, living water. Isn't that the most remarkable thing? One of the things that's quite difficult sometimes with some types of mental health is that when you struggle with your mental health, there's sometimes a thing that you need is medication, but your mental health tells you it's the one thing you shouldn't take. When you need Christ, everything in you says, oh, I don't need him. I don't need him. I'm fine. I'm not hungry. But we need to be honest with ourselves and come to the King, because Jesus can only bless those who are empty, who are hungry. Let's pray together.